Earlier this month, we were talking about the Connecticut State Police Union and how they question if the investigation into falsified traffic tickets has been done prematurely, if it kind of was spilled out to the public too soon, and the backlash that state police are now facing because of this case. And joining us now is somebody who can speak on many levels about this, and that's Andrew Matthews. Andy's been on the show several times before. He's the executive director of the Connecticut State Police Union. He's also the union's legal counsel and former president. So, Andrew, welcome back to the show. How are you?
How you doing, ma'am? Thanks for having us.
I'm glad to have you here. First of all, Andrew, for people who may not be familiar, I know that this news is pretty big in Connecticut, but a quick recap, what exactly is being investigated?
Well, it appears that in 2018, we had four troopers that were investigated, and in 2020, it was determined the sustained charges of intentionally falsifying records, not tickets, but they cleared motor vehicle stops with their terminal, their computer in their car, if they gave a written or verbal warning, and they claimed they did an issued infractions, which turned out not to be true. So I think subsequent to that, the Racial Profiling Project organization did an audit about 8 months ago, started, and they concluded initially that 354 troopers had discrepancies on their records, and they narrowed that down to 130 troopers before they released their findings. And they did an audit from 2014 to 2021. That's what they found. But I think the problem is they jumped to conclusions, assuming that the 130 troopers on their list that were flagged using their metrics had committed the same conduct the original four did. And there's just no evidence of that at this point.
So if I have this correct, Andrew, what you're saying is the people who did the audit, when they identified these issues spanning of about 8 years, kind of it almost was like an overarching putting everybody into one category, saying we've got dozens of troopers who made this issue, and so now we're investigating them. That was a pretty premature sort of blanketed statement to make. Do I have that correct?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest flaws in the audit, we don't mind an audit being done. That's the public's right to know, right? There's no problem with an audit, but before you release information damaging the reputation and the character of troopers or the state police, you should probably inquire further, like speak to the union leadership or the command staff to determine during your audit, subsequent to your audit, before you hold a public hearing, ask questions. Simply put, I'll give a quick example to the public. What they had analyzed was CAD entry, computer-aided dispatch entries. So either a dispatcher or a trooper put information into the computer on motor vehicle stops, okay? Mm-hmm. In the second column, they had the number of e-tickets, like printed tickets. So in a computer, in a cruiser for a state trooper on patrol, they have a terminal which they can actually enter the information, and then they have a printer that prints a ticket. Well, if you don't have a terminal in your cruiser, you have to call it into dispatch on the phone or on the radio, and dispatch enters it, and you hand write a ticket. There's a lot of troopers in the field, about a third of our agency over that eight-year period, that didn't have terminals in their car. So when you called it in, what they didn't take into consideration in their audit, which is why it's important to really analyze the facts forensically, like look at what the truth is, they found discrepancies. So, for example, they have one trooper had 143 tickets in this six-month period from January 1st of 2018 to July 1st of 2018. Mm-hmm. They wrote 97 e-tickets, so they determined there was 46 discrepancies that wasn't actually, and that's what the press is reporting too. That's not true, for example. That means there were 46 handwritten tickets in 97 e-tickets for a total of 143. So we think at the end of all of this, we're not suggesting there aren't additional troopers that did the same thing the first four troopers did, but to accuse or wrongfully characterize and mislead the public into believing that 130 troopers did the same thing is just unfair. And all the union's been saying repeatedly is people are owed due process. If it's determined they committed misconduct, they will be and shall be held accountable.
But it sounds like, Andrew, you're questioning the process and even like the methodology of how this was handled.
Well, I mean, the auditors can do their audit and use whatever metrics they should have, whatever they decided they were going to use. But when you already have, we believe, from our command, 27 troopers from the list of 130 that have already been exonerated. Even the commissioner went to the public hearing and during his testimony said that 5 troopers had been exonerated even before the hearing. So if it's one trooper exonerated from the list of 130, it discredits the audit. It weakens right. the argument that they're trying to make. So we're already up to 27. I know Mr. Barone mentioned last week, he said it's only 17 that have been exonerated. If one is exonerated, and that's why we're so protective of the names of our troopers, we have people suggesting taking the lives of troopers because they're falsely accused of committing misconduct. I mean, this is serious stuff. And I think that in the future, Mr. Barone, if he does this to another agency, what he should do is closely work with leadership, whether it's the union, the troopers in the field, and management, to understand the job and understand the equipment and the technology and how it works and human error that could have resulted in some of the findings. That's all we're saying. But that isn't how this process worked under the current administration. And I would one last point, if I may. In 2018, there's discussion about a 2018 audit. The commissioner and colonel took over in January of 2019. We as a union believe they had a responsibility to thoroughly investigate and clear and exonerate the troopers and investigate those that were wrong, in addition to the 4, back in 2018, 2019. For 5 years, this has been going on, and they did nothing about it.
We have Andrew Matthews here, the executive director of the Connecticut State Police Union. He's also the union's legal counsel and former president from 2010, I believe, until 2018. And I just want to remind folks, when Andrew is referring to Barone, he's talking about Ken Barone, who co-authored the audit that we're discussing. He and his team are part of Racial Profiling Prohibition Project. Andy, I'm curious about the aftermath. So when you hear about the opening lines from basically any Connecticut publication looking at this audit that was released, alleging that 130 Connecticut State Police troopers may have falsified information on at least 26,000 traffic stops over an 8-year period, immediately, if you live in today's world, and you do, people are going to read that headline and they're going to go, I can't trust cops. Right. I mean, I would imagine that there's been a lot of backlash against Connecticut State Police ever since these reports came about.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that over the last 3 years, 3 or 4 years, it's not pleasant to be a police officer or represent. Yeah. It's there's been an attempt to undermine and cause the public to distrust law enforcement. There's a way you can explain things. And the reason we held a press conference last Thursday was because we felt that some in the media were misrepresenting the facts, or they weren't, as they interview us for 2 hours, they don't tell the public the truth about when we're trying to explain to them how the computers work and the difference and what might have inadvertently caused the data to be flagged, right? And that's why if you're doing a thorough and fair and impartial investigation, then you compel people to come in and talk and explain their situation. If there's a rational explanation for you being flagged or the data showing what it is, then why alarm the public to believe that there's this scandal and corruption of the magnitude of which they've described to the public, which we think is inaccurate? And it causes damage, irreparable damage, in our opinion, to the public's view of law enforcement. And that's very unfortunate. It shouldn't happen again in the future. I mean, there's things we can learn from this process to improve future audits as well.
So I want to hear, obviously, about what would be your recommendation. But tell us, you were saying that have state police troopers have their lives or even their family put in jeopardy? Any threats or anything like that?
We had a Facebook posting that was posted by a gentleman, Mr. Corey Lopez, out of Los Angeles. We was determined this week by our major crime squad that suggested to members of the public without evidence, again, that if you were harassed by these police officers that made these fake stops, that you should take their life. You should follow them home and take their life. We have evidence of it. So, you know, it's unfortunate when the press doesn't report it the way it should. And we appreciate the opportunity to talk on your show, because when you talk to the press for 2 hours and they give you three sound bites and they don't tell the public the other, the portions of the story that might exonerate a trooper or explain to the public the truth, it gives a misimpression and it causes the public to be irritated and upset with. We understand, you know, that's understandable. So it's really unfortunate. And there are things, you know, Mr. Barone just announced last week after our press conference that their board is now suggesting to do away with written tickets. We believe that that's because they prematurely released the audit and they realize now that it's the handwritten tickets that nobody analyzed to decide that there are discrepancies from the computer data. Like, there's a difference between what's in the computer and what you analyzed and what's actually handwritten. So if they had slowed down and talked to the right people, including us and the troopers in the field, it may not have caused the alarm that it did.
So I guess, not to jump ahead, Andrew, but would you say that's probably your biggest recommendation after this entire investigation, the fact of let's look at the data and make sure that we talk to all the appropriate parties before we alarm the press? I mean, would that be one of your biggest takeaways?
Well, I mean, our position has always been, and we have a 42-year history of telling the truth and understanding the rights of the public to know. But the public should know. The public can know that there was an audit and they're continuing an investigation to determine if there are any other wrongdoers. And our union has a history of making sure we police our own people as well. So the public doesn't really always get that side of the story from the press. When we know that someone doesn't belong wearing the badge or uniform of a state trooper, we as a union have strongly encouraged and helped them no longer be wearing the uniform or the badge. And I think that gets lost in this. And I think that, again, our command staff failed our agency when Commissioner Rivella and Colonel Malikas knew of this internal audit when they took over in January of 19. It had just concluded a month before they took over. They had a responsibility and an obligation on behalf of the public to look into that audit and all the people that were flagged and determine if there were any other wrongdoers and clear the names of the troopers who now we believe are being falsely accused in Mr. Barone's audit of wrongdoing. It's just simply wrong. These men and women are willing to risk their life for the public and die for the taxpayers. They at least deserve basic due process to be able to be heard and explain the situation and determine if there are any reasons why outside their control that these things happened. Simply put, like, if you didn't have a computer in your car and dispatchers were entering the information, the racial profiling codes into the system, and they didn't, or it didn't accept it or whatever, that's not the trooper's responsibility in the field. But now we've tarnished the good names and reputations of people. And that is unfortunate. And Mr. Barone and his organization should really closely look at that and determine how to avoid that in the future.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Andy, but we're still dealing with a state trooper shortage in our state, right?
Yes, ma'am. We're just over 900 total sworn. We represent 868 troopers, sergeants, and master sergeants. But the high was in 2009 of 1,283 troopers just before Governor Malloy took over. But since then, there's been a drastic reduction. And now these things don't help, right?
Right. Like, that's what I was getting at.
It's already hard. It's already hard enough to recruit and retain troopers or any law enforcement throughout the country. And we have a class of 33 troopers in the academy now. We typically have classes of 80. It's really difficult. And these things don't help when people in the public see that law enforcement is constantly under attack, regardless of the real facts. It doesn't encourage people to want to volunteer and do public service and risk their lives to only be criticized and attacked for doing their job. And it's so unfortunate.
Yeah, well, I think you make a lot of great points. And Andrew Matthews, I want to thank you for what you do. And I hope to have you back on the show very soon. And certainly we're going to continue to follow this case on WICC and bring accurate news. Yeah, thank you.
Be safe.
Thank you
for your time.
You too. Andrew Matthews, again, is the executive director of the Connecticut State Police Union. He's also the union's legal counsel and was the former president from 2010 to 2018. As we slowly approach the month of September, it's a perfect time to talk about PBC awareness, which September is PBC Awareness Month. It's an illness that can destroy your liver, but the major problem is what's called invisible symptoms that are pretty downplayed sometimes when it comes to PBC. And to understand it a little bit better, we have Dr. Charles Cha back on the show with us, a liver and pancreas surgeon with Hartford Healthcare St. Vincent's Medical Center. Dr. Cha, welcome. How are you?
Very good. Good morning.
I'm glad to have you here. First of all, I was not even going to botch what PBC stands for, so I'm going to have you do that, not botch it, but tell us what that stands for and what exactly is this illness?
Sure. It is PBC, standing for primary biliary cholangitis, and it's a bit of a mouthful. We used to call it primary biliary cirrhosis, but it doesn't always involve cirrhosis of the liver. Biliary just means bile ducts. Cholangitis means inflammation of the bile ducts. And essentially, it is inflammation of the bile ducts within the microscopic cells of the liver that are inflamed due to your own body attacking itself, an autoimmune disease, so to speak. So kind of like arthritis attacks your own joints, this is a disease where your own body attacks its own liver.
How can you develop this? So whenever I think of the liver, I always think alcohol abuse is one of the biggest killers for your liver. But how do you get PBC?
People don't really know exactly what the cause is. There's not one defined thing that you do that potentially puts you at higher risk. Some people think smoking increases your risk a little bit, but it's unfortunately just something that happens. Fortunately, it's not something that happens very often. It's a relatively rare disease. That being said, in some estimates, it's up to one female patient per 1,000 to 2,000 of the U.S. population will develop it. It tends to attack women over the age of 40, 10 times more so than men. So it's something that we ought to have on our radar and we ought to have awareness about. Because if we can detect it early and we can treat it, it's very treatable. If it's something that we don't know about and we're sort of too late in the game in discovering it, it leads to cirrhosis and potentially liver failure. And ultimately, some of these patients do need liver transplants.
Wow. Now, why women? Why a larger population of women? Why are they at higher risk? And are we talking about women just in general over the age of 40, or are we talking about moms?
We don't really know. I wish I could answer that question. There's not a whole lot known about it. That's part of the reason why I think we need more awareness so that we can, you know, draw more interest and generate more dollars for research for something that we need to know more about. But it tends to be true for all autoimmune diseases that they tend to affect women more than men for some reason, and we don't know exactly why. But
crazy.
It's not related to childbirth that we know of, but it tends to affect women over the age of 40 in terms of onset.
So we have Dr. Charles Cha here, and we're talking about this invisible disease, PBC, and how it impacts a lot of people. It's kind of known as an invisible disease. Is it overlooked a lot, Dr. Cha? Like, is this something that you can screen for, or people just wait too long? Like, why is it an invisible disease, I guess?
Well, I think if you can detect this early, and by early I mean before the onset of symptoms, it's something that potentially your life expectancy will not be affected. The best way to detect it is by just having some labs drawn where they check some of your liver functions, and if they see an elevation, they can do further testing to make that determination and make that diagnosis. And once that diagnosis is made, there's some relatively simple medications that can be given that you would just take the rest of your life to kind of prevent this from really progressing. If you start to have symptoms, depending on what those are, sometimes that's just itchiness, sometimes that's just fatigue early on, you still can be treated, and the majority of patients do not go into liver failure, cirrhosis, or even liver transplantation. But the more symptoms that you have, the worse prognosis you have, so to speak. So if you can catch it early before you have symptoms, that's going to be the best.
Okay, and what would you say are some of the most common symptoms that people will have if they are experiencing PBC?
Yes, PBC. Essentially, no symptoms is ideal, but early on, things that are related to your liver not processing bile well. So when it backs up, then you can turn yellow, so-called jaundice. You can get itchiness, called pruritus. And then the later symptoms are just related to progressive liver failure. So you can have some difficulty absorbing fat-soluble vitamins, and you can have some diarrhea. As things get worse, you can start having an enlarged liver. You can have bleeding from either your GI tract, either by vomiting or through your GI tract when you have your diarrhea, you have bowel movements with blood within them. Then later stages are just related to anybody having bad cirrhosis, meaning not being able to coagulate your blood well, having fluid in your belly and progressive liver failure symptoms. A lot of these can be mitigated with early treatment, but ultimately around 6% of patients with this disease, primary biliary cholangitis, will eventually require liver transplantation. With cirrhosis also increases your risk of cancer, particularly primary liver cancer, or hepatocellular carcinoma.
Wow. Dr. Cha, I've read a couple of articles on PBC recently, and it says that unfortunately these invisible symptoms can sometimes be downplayed by doctors and even loved ones, and it's hard for others to truly understand the complete impact on their lives without experiencing what they're going through themselves. Correct me if I'm wrong, but there's no like screening process. It's not like if you're checking for certain cancers, you can, you know, get a mammogram or something like that. There's no screening process for PBC, correct?
Well, there, fortunately, compared to other types of cancers, you will see elevations in your liver enzymes on not standard labs, but if you do check liver function tests, what you will see are elevations in those numbers. So that should trigger further investigation if they're seen on labs. Unfortunately, there are a lot of other type of diseases that can cause mild elevations in your liver functions. And so it does get overlooked sometimes because you see a mild elevation in those numbers, and then it's attributed to, say, fatty liver or maybe alcoholism or other things that may or may not be related. Those other things, poor diet, obesity, alcohol use will obviously accelerate primary biliary cholangitis because it's just going to attack the liver with more vigor if you injure your liver in other ways. But there are ways that physicians can screen for this disease. It's just not always followed up appropriately because there are much more complicated measures that need to be done, whether that's a liver biopsy or a specific test that tests for PBC specifically, that might not be thought of or might not be done in follow-up to mildly elevated liver function tests. And so I think it takes an astute clinician and somebody who has this in the back of their mind to pick up this disease, because it is relatively rare and it's not something that a lot of doctors are immediately familiar with, but it's something that it can make a big impact if it's detected early, because if it's detected early, it won't impact your life whatsoever. If it's not detected early, it really will progressively injure the liver to the point where you will need potentially a liver transplant if you're not treated accordingly.
Wow. So it's really important that if you are feeling any of those symptoms, to make sure you advocate for yourself, ask for those tests, and certainly try to catch this as soon as you can. And such great information, Dr. Cha, and especially for women listening this morning over the age of 40, really important that you keep an eye out for those symptoms and to make sure that you advocate for yourself with your doctors and your loved ones. Thank you so much for this information, Dr. Cha. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And again, Dr. Cha is a liver and pancreas surgeon with Hartford HealthCare's St. Vincent's Medical Center here on WICC.
Fighting against injustice across Connecticut, Melissa in the Morning checks in with the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities. Now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
And as we head into a brand new school year, one of the biggest fears that parents have is bullying. And unfortunately, in today's age, it's so easy for kids to be targeted by bullies, not just in school, but out of school because of social media and technology. So we have Michelle back on the show with us with the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities to talk about bullying and how we can better address it across the state of Connecticut. Michelle, welcome. So glad to have you here. How are you?
Thank you. I'm good. I just put my little kiddos on the bus this morning.
Oh,
they all
my gosh.
Got off. So, it's a busy day, and it's a really, really relevant topic. And
yeah.
I think, we're all afraid when we send our kids to school because we try to protect them the best we can in our environment. But when they are there, they are there. But thankfully, we have really great safeguards in Connecticut in order to address situations at school where bullying may occur. And they come in kind of a couple different ways. So back in 2010, the state legislature passed a series of laws that talked about safe schools and bullying and safe climates within the school. And what that did is it had specific requirements that related to bullying students and then just the social climates within the schools. And so every school is required to have a certain set of structures in order to essentially always gauge what's going on in the school and provide an environment that's safe for students to make their needs known if they are being bullied. Because I think that's really the key with a lot of this is the safety aspect of it. It's so difficult when you're in school and you don't want to look like you're getting people in trouble, but it's not right to be bullied on top of that either. So the safety aspects of being able to report are very important.
That's really reassuring. I know we're sending our kiddo off to kindergarten for the first time. And
my goodness, there's a lot of fears when I did that.
Yeah. So it's funny, Michelle, I feel like my biggest fear, honestly, is not even the adjustment period and the, oh my God, my baby's growing up. None of that. I'm really excited for him. Like, I actually am very, very excited for my son. I think he is so excited to finally learn. He doesn't want to do as much playtime as he did in preschool. Like, he's stoked. And I'm very excited for him. But my biggest fear is pretty much the same fear he has, which is how do I know that kids are not making fun of me and they are actually legitimate friends, because he has been bullied already. Like, he has been a target of you know, the butt of jokes before and not realizing that he is in the midst of being picked on. And so I guess to hear that there are safeguards is a really good thing. We've had some issues just in the past couple of years. You may remember in Fairfield, for example, there was an issue with Snapchat where those images go away very quickly. But somebody was quick enough, clever enough to take a snapshot of it before it could disappear. But it was racially charged. It was certainly attacking a student. It was going across to however many students in that school. And that student who did take the Snapchat, I believe, was suspended and had to face penalties for that. But tell us about, like, the social media aspect of it, and what rights, I guess, do schools or even parents have to say, hey, I have proof that my kid is being bullied on the internet. Maybe it's not happening within the walls of the school, but it's happening and it's connected to peers that they go to school with.
So they do have significant rights. You know, as I said earlier, I was talking about more generally bullying, but when we're talking about bullying that relates to a protected class, of which we have many, many in Connecticut, the commission has jurisdiction over those cases. And it's one of the frequent types of cases we get for our what we call public accommodation cases, or cases within school systems where a student is being discriminated against. And that discrimination often comes out as bullying. And that can be within the school or it can be outside of the school, for which that would be part of the complaint, because as we all know, it's very difficult to separate the two. And so if you have a fellow student, a teacher, anyone who's associated with the school engaging in this sort of behavior, you can't just separate that out and say, oh, well, you know, I got this on my phone at night, and when I go to school, I'm going to pretend I didn't see it. That just doesn't happen. So our statutes at the commission allow us under a statute called 10-15C to investigate and prosecute cases of discrimination as it relates to race, color, gender identity, and which is a big one, and sexual orientation, religion, disability. There's a number of protected classes, gender, because that happens to under 10-15C, which gives the commission the jurisdiction to investigate these cases and to provide different remedies that are not available under what would be the State Department of Education's jurisdiction. For discrimination complaints, we do have those remedies, and they look like all sorts of things, including affirmative relief, which is just changes within the school system to the best they can ensure that these sorts of situations don't happen again. I can say under the safe school climate statutes, everybody is a mandatory reporter too. It's not just the teachers. It's not just the principal. It's every person who works in the school is required to report any instances of bullying that they see to the principal and the safe school climate officer. So there really is meant to be a lot of safeguards, but you know, we really pick up from there with the remedies in terms of doing investigations, affirmative relief, financial relief, if there's been that type of a damage associated with kids being bullied, because a lot of the times it is related to a protected class. It's, you know, somebody may have a disability, somebody may have a different color of their skin or be a different gender identity or sexual orientation. It doesn't, unfortunately, take too much for students to notice the differences and to try to exploit the differences. And that's why we're here.
So again, we have Michelle here with the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities, and we're talking about combating bullying in the state of Connecticut. In fact, across the globe, bullying has always been an issue, but it's gotten excessively harder to manage bullying because of cell phones and social media and just technology in general. Michelle, do you worry at all, or could you talk a little bit about the fact that we now have tablets as a pretty standard thing that students get even at the elementary level? What is in place for our age group, we've got a lot of parents who their kids have never touched a tablet, mine included. Mine's mm-hmm. never used a tablet before. But I do know that there are safeguards in place to make sure that kids can't just wander on the internet and things like that. Could you discuss mm-hmm. that maybe for parents who don't realize that when you're getting handed a tablet at a public school, there are safeguards that the school is required to put into place on that property?
Sure, 100%. So the tablets themselves, and I know my kids have Chromebooks, they do have the computer security folks who work in towns, you know, do a really great job of making sure that there is software that does not allow for from non-school related activities. That being said, I can tell just from my own experience, there are some pretty handy children out there who know how to kind of work their way around things. And so I think, you know, just like anything else, what students need to know is that if they have any sort of contact on their school-issued Chromebook, their school-issued iPad or tablet, that they do need to let somebody know. Because just because those things are in place in which they're really sturdy, it doesn't mean that things won't happen. Even in a normal school setting, kids get school-issued emails. And so they can, just in the text of an email that wouldn't necessarily flag, I know they flag for certain words, get some harassing emails that may pass through the filters and seem benign but are not benign. It's really important, again, that students feel comfortable to report that, because school is hard enough. And having this kind of extra aura around them because they're being bullied, they really do need to report it, because things will come through that, like I said earlier, may seem very benign, but are not. And so the students need to talk to their parents, obviously, and they also need to just report, because the school's not going to know. I would say, you know, the majority of the time the school is obviously not condoning any of this behavior, but it's a lot of moving parts with children in schools and with technology that is issued by the school to keep track of. And so I think, again, that safety in reporting, that comfort in reporting really goes a long way to make sure that children are learning and not being bullied.
We're talking to the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities. Our friend Michelle is back on the show, and we're discussing bullying. Now, Michelle, you had mentioned just a couple of minutes ago, teachers, I believe by law, are mandatory reporters, meaning if they see bullying, they have to report it. No questions asked.
Yes.
They have to report
everyone in the school. Everyone. The custodians, secretary in the office, everyone has to report. Yes.
Anybody who is part of the administration, anybody who is part of the school staff has to report. Now, what about students?
They're not mentioned in the statute.
I think that's interesting. I think that's really interesting.
It's interesting, too. I mean, I think that one of the things, too, again, has been kind of going on, because this is not just in school bullying, it's everywhere. The comfort to report discrimination is incredibly important, because if people don't feel comfortable, they don't think anything will come of it, they won't say anything. And so there is an anti-retaliation prohibition in the statute, the school statute, for those who do report bullying, so that if a student were to report bullying, because sometimes that happens, the student is reporting bullying of themselves, but they're reporting bullying of another student that they're concerned about. That student themselves can't be retaliated against. And that is, the retaliation provision is all over our statute. And so because we want to make it safe for people to report, you cannot be retaliated. I mean, you can be retaliated against, but there's remedies available to you if you are, for just being a witness to a case, giving us any sort of a statement. If something negative happens to you after, then you yourself can file a complaint, even though you weren't the one who was initially bullied, because we want the people responsible to recognize that they have to be, you know, really meaningful about this and not become, you know, retaliatory because they don't want their school name out there. They don't want their own name out there. You know, it doesn't take, Connecticut's not a humongous state, and it doesn't take too long
to figure out who's
for
the
people
culprit,
to get
if
to
you
know.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so, and I think that's important. And I also wanted to mention, too, that while the school climate statutes say, you know, you want to notify people as soon as possible, the commission, and for our jurisdiction, you do have to come with us within 300 days of the discriminatory incident. So it isn't a forever. And a lot of the times with schools and school bullying, it tends to be a continuing issue throughout the school year, maybe into the following school year. And it's very important that people come to us within the 300 days in order to get in most of the timeline of their bullying, or we won't have jurisdiction over it. So it's very important. 300 days seems like a long time, but in a school year, you know, my kids are starting school today. In a snap, it'll be June, and I'll be looking at them sitting on my couch. So time goes by fast when these things are happening, and it's extremely important that you come to the commission within that 300 days in order to make sure that we do have jurisdiction over the complaint.
Sure. And even though it's not in the statute, Michelle, I guess my point was, with bringing up the students, that's more than 50% of most schools. I mean, there's always going to be smaller schools, of course, but I mean, when you look at a generic public school, I would say more than 50% of the people that's filling up that building are students. So the fact that they are not required to report, I do think, means that we have a lot of under-reporting going on of bullying. What would you suggest to parents to discuss with their kids about the importance of stepping up and saying, hey, if you see something that's not right, not necessarily do you have to get involved and say, hey, it's not okay, because you could put yourself in the middle of being the next target, but the importance of reporting it, even if it's anonymous, to make sure you say something.
I agree 100%. I think that this is a very tender age for, you know, from kindergarten all the way up to, my oldest son is a senior in high school this year, and it's all of it is filled with, you know, who am I, you know, what do people think about me? But I do think it's what you said is extremely important for parents to have continued honest and open communication with their students if they see their friends, you know, being treated in a negative way. And then you can strategize. You know, maybe it's the parent who contacts the school. Maybe it is the parent who contacts the guidance counselor, or somebody that they're comfortable with and that the student is comfortable with talking to, so that, you know, once the school is triggered with knowledge, regardless of who is getting that knowledge, then they do have an obligation to do the investigation. They have an obligation to let the parents know. And so I think that while it may be that people don't feel necessarily comfortable to go to, you know, somebody, the principal, say, there usually is somebody they do feel comfortable who can kind of carry the ball for them with protecting their friends or themselves. Mm. Because it is it's a tender time in kids' lives. So I think it's a lot of balancing needs to go on.
Yeah.
But in the end, everyone suffers. I have never seen a situation where one student's bullying is confined to one other student. There is repercussions amongst many students when that occurs. Even if they're not the direct target of the bullying, they see what's happening. It's negative to all around, not just the one person it's potentially targeted at. So it's important.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree with you. And Michelle, thank you so much for talking about this. I know, again, it's a huge issue that continues to be a problem generation to generation. But again, it feels like harder and harder to manage. And certainly you've mm-hmm. given a lot of great information to parents sending their kids off, including yourself. So thank you so much.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too. Good luck to your kiddos and happy school year to everybody. Here we go. Unbelievable. Thanks, Michelle. Appreciate it. Michelle with the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities here on WICC. According to national statistics, about 6 million Americans have vision loss and 1 million are completely blind. And this morning we are highlighting a vision impaired couple who are advocating for the blind across the state of Connecticut. We want to welcome Honorata and Phil to the show. Good morning to both of you. Thank you for joining WICC. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having us.
Good
morning.
We're doing
well.
I'm glad to have you both here. And can you both pronounce your last name so that I don't mess them up on the air? Because I would hate to do that to both of you. That's a horrible way to start off our friendship, don't you think?
Of course. I am Phil McGalnick, and my wife is?
Honorata Kazimierczak.
What a beautiful name. Well, thank you both for being here. And tell us a little bit about your diagnoses and what led you to want to educate the public about those who have vision impairments.
Certainly, we are both blind secondary to retinitis pigmentosa, which is a degenerative retinal disease. I was diagnosed in my teens, Honorata in her 20s. And as it progressed slowly, we were able to have careers. Her as an art teacher, me as a police dispatcher in Stamford. And it became a matter of survival where the advocacy became inherent to who we are. It had to be self-advocacy, and then that turned into advocacy on a larger scale. And here we are today, from, you know, City Hall to the halls of Capitol Hill.
That's amazing. So both of you are also matched with guide dogs, which the dogs came from Fidelco Guide Dog Foundation. Can you tell us a little bit about them and tell us about your dogs?
Phil had gotten a guide dog in 2018, and we actually met because he made a post that he had received acceptance letter. The Fidelco Guide Dog Foundation, as we know, has been training and providing dogs to the blind for over 50 years, and they're located in Bloomfield, Connecticut. They solely, and they're the only school in the nation who trained solely German Shepherd guide dogs, so that's their specialty. And Phil, upon acceptance, had, maybe I should let him speak, had felt more freedom.
She's a little rattled. So I had posted on Facebook, I got one. We were friends without knowing it. And then that's how we met. And we were married 3 months ago. And 4 months ago, she received her German Shepherd guide dog, Carrie. So now we're a tandem team of guide dog handlers.
I love that. So first of all, congratulations. That's a beautiful story. And you now have Chloe and you said Kari?
Carrie, C-A-R-I.
Okay. And the both of them came from the same foundation. What have these dogs done for both of you since adding them to your families?
Well, the independence is just a sense of being able to know that you're safe in traveling, I think, is the big thing. We do quite a bit of traveling, whether it be by train, by bus, by Uber, by airplane, and the sense of really feeling that we are able to navigate on our own and independently, I think, is what really drew us to the guide dogs in the beginning. Using a cane is great, but oftentimes we have to rely on other people or technology to get where we're going, and that's often slow. This just speeds up the process, and we literally fly down the sidewalks.
Wow. Wow. So obviously they've kind of diminished your anxiety when it comes to traveling anywhere. But also it sounds like they've almost partnered up with you to educate the public. What are some things that you both teach people, not just, you know, locally, but it sounds like you're going even to a national level about making communities safer for those who are have a vision impairment?
That's a big part of what we do, leading by example. Because we must walk everywhere for the most part, we really incur obstacles, whether they be physical or not, on our sidewalks. And being involved in our local government and part of the state government with commissions and committees we serve on, we're able to have that platform to let people know that, you know, access to the sidewalks, the public right of way, is a must for people like us and people with other disabilities as well. And the dogs help draw some attention to us, and that begins a conversation. And I think demonstrating and letting people see how it affects people like us is a big way of getting it through to people rather than just talking about it. So the demonstration is a big part of it.
So Phil and Honorata have an amazing story. They just got married just a few months ago. They are both vision impaired, and this Connecticut couple is advocating for the blind across the state and even across the country. Phil, can you just describe, you were saying, you know, we're going from City Hall to Capitol Hill. What are some things that you are proposing? What do you want to see done, not just for Connecticut residents, but for everybody across the country who are dealing with an impairment?
There are so many things we could take your whole show over, but some of the things that right now with the blindness, you know, with a guide dog, is being able to travel independently and safely. And that's probably the most important thing, because if we're stuck in the house and we're afraid to go somewhere because we know places are not accessible or sidewalks are not accessible or stores are not accessible, that's something that is the fundamental right for all Americans, to be able to travel safely and independently. The other things that we are concerned about is web accessibility. Many websites and apps are not accessible to us using a screen reader. And it's not only against the Americans with Disabilities Act, but it's really not the right thing to do when we cannot access a government website to retrieve information or find out what's going on in our community. It makes it tough for us to be part of the society. And the buzzwords these days are disabilities, not included typically in diversity, equity, and inclusion. And we're trying to insert that into the conversation.
Likewise, I think that a lot of what we do is also related to ride share and other transportation issues surrounding the denials of the service dogs. And we try to educate people on the differences and demeanor and how the guide dogs specifically behave differently from the fake service dogs. And, you know, being denied so many times, especially for Phil, as he has been a guide dog user for 5 years, he has experienced probably about under 20 denials that might have resulted in somebody being fired. And this is the last thing that we want. We want people to be employed and doing the right thing.
Wow.
Likewise, I've been using Carrie now, working with Carrie now, going to work. And she, through her behavior, has been basically educating everyone around her that dogs, guide dogs in the workplace are not distracting, that they behave quite well and they're quiet and they do not interfere with anybody else's work.
No, these dogs are brilliant. I mean, and the amount of training that they go through is just, it's substantial. It's different than, I would say, like sometimes, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I would believe that people have a misconception of a guide dog versus an anxiety dog. So when people have pets there for comfort, like a comfort pet versus a seeing eye dog. The training is completely different. I mean, you could have a dog who, you know, helps you with your anxiety, for example, but didn't go through any kind of lengthy training. It just helps you, and you've got a doctor's order basically saying, yeah, you could bring your dog into the office. That's completely different than what a seeing eye dog is, kind of what they register in their brains. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, that's a big issue we're dealing with right now. You know, there is a place for comfort and emotional support animals, granted, but per federal law, the only place you could bring those dogs, it's transportation and housing related. A person cannot bring their emotional support animal into, say, a grocery store. Only guide dogs are permitted by law, a service dog. And that's because these dogs are not just providing comfort, but they're providing a service. They are
right, they're literally navigating you, right?
Exactly. And a little dog, although may be trained and behave well, it's still a dog, and it can distract my dog. And when my dog gets distracted, someone can, you know, I could get hurt. Someone else could get hurt.
So the guide dogs, the Fidelco Guide Dog Foundation trains and pairs up with the handlers are task driven. They do aid in mobility. They find the curbs. They find the stairs, the escalators, elevators, you know, doors that we need to get in and out of. We still need to have great orientation skills to be able to know where we are going. But without their assistance, we couldn't do stuff as quickly as with them.
Mm-hmm. We have Phil and Honorata here who are taking their story of dealing with blindness and educating the public, not just about making safer communities, but also understanding the importance of their seeing eye dogs, their guide dogs. And we've been talking a little bit about both Chloe and Carrie. And I know both of you have also become volunteer puppy raisers for the foundation where you got your dogs, which is incredible. And I wanted to talk about specifically in Connecticut what you both are fighting for. Obviously, the importance of recognizing these guide dogs and making sure that they are properly handled in public places, like you were saying, the grocery store. But what are you seeing in Connecticut specifically that sparked your interest in wanting to educate the public more and to see some changes?
Certainly. A couple of years back, I think it was just prior to the pandemic, the inception, we were at the Connecticut General Assembly at a subcommittee testifying essentially about fake service animals. A lot of people can go online to Amazon or eBay and buy a vest that says service animal. They can register for $10 at a website and get a little certificate and an ID card saying they have an emotional support animal or a comfort dog, or sometimes service animals in general. And that's against the spirit of the law, but also against the ADA itself. And so we were there testifying, and some woman was before us and talked about how her dog and her took an online course, and she has this ID tag, and her dog has an ID tag, and she liked the same rights as people with service animals like us to go anywhere with a dog. And, you know, it was our turn time to testify. And we essentially said that, you know, this woman was bamboozling the subcommittee because I doubt the dog took an online course itself and knew what to do and how to behave. So fortunately, that was struck down. And again, a service animal by statute in federal law, in Connecticut would follow that law, is that it's a dog or a miniature horse trained to perform a specific task to mitigate a disability for a particular person. So while a comfort dog can be brought into certain places where it's allowed to provide comfort and some greetings to sick or disabled or elderly people, that's great, or in stressful situations, it's great. But it's not trained to perform a particular task to mitigate a disability for a particular person. That's what my dog does. I'm blind, and my dog is used for orientation and mobility. And it keeps us safe. So that's something we're still dealing with all the time. And I don't know how it will get better.
So what can people do, Phil and Honorata? What do you want listeners to do this morning? Is there anything in particular that they can do to better advocate for this or look for changes in Connecticut?
I would hope that all the people who are very tempted by passing their fake service dogs only to have them by their side all the time would take a second look at that and just really reconsider, because it does cause interference. Most of those dogs are not adequately trained, not just to perform a task, but they're not, they do not have basic obedience training. So they bark in a public places. They may relieve themselves or, you know, have other situational problems that are not true for service dogs. So they're kind of confusing the public. And then through that, we face discrimination, and we have to, you know, unnecessarily explain ourselves being the rightful handlers of true service dogs.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. And Phil and Honorata, I want to thank you so much for the work that you do and for bringing this to not only Connecticut, but for all that you're bringing across the country. I wish you luck, and please keep us posted if there's any updates. We'd love to continue telling your story on air.
Will do. Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you, Melissa.
Yes,
thank you for having us.
Yeah, absolutely. We really appreciate it. Again, Phil and Honorata, an incredible story. And what they're doing to educate the public is certainly nothing short of extraordinary. We're glad to tell their story here on WICC.